rise. Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, City of Austin, is now in session.
Thank you so much. Y'all can be seated. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Third Court of Appeals. It's a pleasure to have you all here today. As you know, today, the case before us is case number 0322219 CV Volkswagen Group of America, Inc. et al. Versus the State of Texas and the TCEQ. This morning, we are proceeding with oral argument. Each side will have 20 minutes. My understanding is the appellant is going to take 15 minutes to open, and then the state will use their 20 minutes in argument, and then we'll have rebuttal by the appellants of 5 minutes. As you know, we also are recording this proceeding today and broadcasting it live on YouTube. So all your friends and family, I'm sure, are huddled around their computers watching, waiting to hear the wise words that you have to present to the Third Court today. I would appreciate it if counsels would announce themselves ready and introduce themselves to the court, please. Let me hear first from Volkswagen.
Chief Justice Berger, Chuck Wall for Volkswagen. I do proceed this morning.
Good morning, Mr. Wall.
Chief Justice Berger, Lenora Pettit for the state. I'm ready to proceed this morning.
Thank you, Ms. Pettit. And my apologies for failing to introduce my fellow justices. We've got Justice Smith and Justice Triana here today, and we're all pleased to have you here. And thank you for the good briefing. With that, we will proceed. So, Mr. Wall, you may proceed, sir.
Chief Justice Byrne, and may it please the court.
Yes, sir.
There are two straightforward ways to resolve this case. First, the review provision is mandatory. Its text says so. It carries the same declaratory judgment remedy as all of its sister requirements, and treating it as directory would gut the legislature's purposes. Or second, even if the review provision were directory, TCEQ did not substantially comply when it waited 15 years to review the tampering rule. Whatever leeway agencies have, they can't miss the deadline by more than a decade. That narrower fact-specific ruling would respect the legislature's purpose in this case, and it would affect only this rule, and as far as we can tell, only this set of enforcement actions. I welcome the court's questions this morning.
Thank you. And counsel, as it relates to mandatory versus directory, with that analysis, is it primarily your argument that it's mandatory because of the language in the statute, but also because it's subject to the declaratory judgment action review in the Administrative Procedures Act? And if so, if it's the second, wouldn't that make every rule a mandatory rule because all of them are subject to the declaratory judgment review?
So it's more the it's all of the factors, Chief Justice Byrne. So under the Chisholm line of cases, as I understand them, you look first to the text, then you also look to whether the statute carries a consequence, and you look to the legislature's purposes. And here, what we'd say is all three of those factors cut in favor of saying it's mandatory. So just to start quickly with the text, it's not just shall in the Code Construction Act, though I think that's pretty powerful standing alone. It's also the juxtaposition between shall and may in the surrounding requirements. It is, as Professor Beal explains, the use of the word readopt. So we know not just the front-end action, but the back-end action. And that's textually really important. If you look at cases like Sheps, what the Texas Supreme Court said was, it's not just the notice requirement on the front-end, it's the back-end requirement to do something else. There it was to certify that you'd provide the notice. Here it's not just the upfront review, you got to take a back-end action too. That's what separates it from all the other timing cases.
And what is the consequence for failing to do the back-end? Let's say you just failed by day.
I think
it's void.
So I don't think the court has to get into it here because I don't think the state has any argument that it substantially complied from 2014 to 2016. Has an argument it substantially complied as of 2019, but not earlier. I don't read anything in its briefs to say hey, look, we thought we did it, but we left it off the list by mistake. Or we wanted to, but we didn't have the resources. Their brief is just silent on why they waited more than a decade. So if the court says it's directory, but the state didn't substantially comply on the facts here because it waited more than a decade, you don't have to answer, I think, the tough line drawing questions about what about a month or a year. But if the state is right that it substantially complied, then that does tee up the question of whether it's mandatory or directory, and then the line drawing questions matter very much. Because if it's mandatory, the state has to strictly comply. And until they readopt, as Professor Beal explains in his brief, the rule is not valid. Now, the state holds the keys. It can readopt at any time. And it's not an onerous burden. When they readopted here in 2019, if you look at the readoption and you set aside all the boilerplate, it's a sentence, one sentence. All the state says is, we find that the reasons for having these rules exist. And they readopt the entire chapter, all the rules. They don't make a single change. So I don't understand the state's argument that this is very onerous. A lot of agencies do this. And going back to your first question, Chief Justice, it's not just the text. It is that there's a remedy spelled out in the statute, which is the declaratory judgment remedy. I think the state concedes that's available for everything else in subchapter B. If an agency doesn't provide notice, it doesn't allow comment, it doesn't publish the rule properly, I think all of the sister requirements are subject to the declaratory judgment action. So I don't.
Let me ask you a question. So how do you, I mean, in AC interest, the Supreme Court specifically said that to determine whether a timing provision is mandatory, we first look to whether the statute contains a noncompliant penalty. And in that case, there was not, also like this case, there was not a noncompliant penalty, and they determined that it was directory. So how do you, why would you argue that in this case, it would not be directory?
So Justice Trial, I think AC interest is very helpful. Like, yes, the court said it's directory, but the methodology it used, and it's the same methodology it used in opinion Davis v. Morath a few years ago on a teacher appraisal statute, it looked at the statute as a whole, and it said, well, there is this separate provision that says if you don't prosecute for 1 year, you get dismissed. So we know then that just not serving the petition within the 30-day time limit can't result in dismissal, because we have a separate provision for that where the legislature said it. So they looked at the statute as a whole, they drew it from context. That's all we're asking for here. If you look at subchapter B, that declaratory judgment cause of action remedy applies to everything else in subchapter B. I don't think the state disputes that. I think the state acknowledges that that applies to any other challenge to a validity or applicability of the rule. So then the question is, can the state get some carve out that all other validity and applicability challenges carry a declaratory judgment with them, but not violations of the rule provision? And I don't think that's a reasonable way to read all of these provisions in context. So I think in context, it's pretty clear that the declaratory judgment action applies. We're challenging the validity of a rule. As they said in the trial court, this is the appropriate vehicle for bringing this to the court. And then the last of the three factors is the legislature's purposes. And if you get there, I mean, I don't want to lose the forest for the trees. This is all supposed to be a question of legislative intent. If the state is right, the review provision is meaningless. Agencies can sit around for more than a decade, do nothing, wait until they're challenged, engage in a pro forma readoption, and there is no consequence, none. And it's just unimaginable to me that the legislature that enacted this review provision would have thought that it could be treated like that.
Well, what do we do, because in my mind, you know, under, I think it's 040, the remedy, if we were to find that there was a procedural problem, would be to go ahead and remand it and have the agency, you know, either readopt it, comply with the procedure. So even if we were to agree with you and say, okay, wouldn't that be the relief? Wouldn't, you know, us sending it back to the agency, assuming they hadn't in 2019, gone ahead and readopted it, wouldn't that be the adequate remedy?
No, Justice Trina, and this is a very important textual point, and its importance applies beyond this case. If you look at point 040, both its text and its legislative history, it was adopted, and its text says it's paired with point 035. So there are these various procedural requirements that where the state is allowed a substantial compliance defense. For those, for the ones from point 024 to point 035, the ones that are staked out in the substantial compliance scheme, point 040 says, if you find a violation of one of those sets of requirements, then you, court, have a choice. You may void, Or you may leave the rule in effect, remand it to the agency, and allow the agency to fix the problem. Maybe it was a notice problem, a comment problem, what have you. The review provision is outside that scheme. It's not among the requirements listed in .040. It's not among the requirements listed in .035. There are other requirements besides the review provision in subchapter B that aren't listed there, that aren't a part of that substantial compliance regime. That was a choice by the legislature, I think a conscious choice, and it has consequences, which is to say there isn't a substantial compliance defense, and it isn't subject to that voidability provision at .040.
Couldn't you also argue that the reason why it's carved out is because there is no consequence for failing to do the review, and so therefore they didn't even have to address its directory, and so therefore they didn't even have to address substantial compliance? And that's what the legislature intended by not putting 40 in, or 39 into section 40.
So I do take that to be the state's argument, Chief Justice Byrne. I have to say two things. One, I don't see any indication in the review provisions text, or if you run the Chisholm analysis by the factors, I don't see which of the factors gets you there. The text has more indication here that it's mandatory than in other cases where this court and the Texas Supreme Court have found statutes mandatory, based on the back-end action, the readoption language, the juxtaposition of shall and may. There's a consequence spelled out in the statute that was not true in the other statutes. And here, I think if the agency can just sit around for a decade and do nothing, we can all agree that the provision is a dead letter. But I also wonder how far the state's willing to carry its argument. There are other provisions in subchapter B that sit outside the substantial compliance regime, like .036 or .037, right? 036 says a rule takes effect after 20 days unless it's an emergency rule. 037 tells you what to do if there's some conflict in the text. If we imagine an agency that wanted to apply a rule, a non-emergency rule, on day one, or didn't apply it according to its text in the case of a conflict, I assume the state would concede that a regulated party would have a declaratory judgment action to have the rule declared invalid because the agency wasn't following the law. I assume the state would not be here saying that's entirely directory, even though it says shall. You can apply the rule from day one, even if it's a non-emergency rule. We wouldn't think that way about any of the other provisions in subchapter B that contain similar language if a regulated party came in here in the face of an agency that was clearly violating the law. And so the question, I think, really ought to be, why would we treat the review provision differently? Its text is stronger. There's no textual or logical reason why it wouldn't carry a declaratory judgment remedy. And we know that it would gut the legislature's purposes. At that point, all I understand the state to say is it would be chaos. You would have rules drift in and out of effect, and this would be very disruptive for administrative agencies in Texas. And I take that point, but I guess I'd say a few things. One, that's just a naked policy argument. It's not part of Chisholm. No court has ever sort of just thrown up their hands and said, we're going to treat it as directory because it would be really disruptive to make the state do what the legislature told it to do. But even if you get past that and you thought it was part of the analysis, as we point out at page 26 of the reply in footnote 2, it sure seems like other agencies do this. And when you get to the chaos part of Texas's brief, I would have thought that if this was a big deal, the state would say, look, here are all the agencies that don't have the resources to comply. Here are all the enforcement actions that would be imperiled. Here are all the costs we would incur. And there's none of that. And the reason is that the state knows that agencies are doing what TCEQ did in 2019. They are adopting these rules on the basis of very short notices and with an explanation again and again that just says, we find the same reasons for the rules exist. So I don't think the state can honestly say it's incredibly onerous, because agencies, many other agencies, are doing it, and it's not that onerous.
But so isn't, aren't you, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Aren't you arguing that they shouldn't be doing it a pro forma? I thought that was part of your argument. And I guess my question is, what language in the statute precludes the TCEQ from doing a pro forma readoption?
Oh, unlike Professor Beal, I don't think the court needs to get into that. I'm not tackling the 2019 readoption. Right? Whether or not that's valid can wait for another party who's regulated under the post-2019 version of the rule. Our case is simple. It's mandatory and they didn't strictly comply. But again, I don't need the court to agree with me on that. But the court could say, even if it's directory, you don't substantially comply when you wait more than a decade. That takes care of the facts of this case. It affects no other cases and no other rules.
But how do you get to, if in 2019, if we're not going to argue about whether they can or cannot do it pro forma. If in 2019 the agency has decided that there's still reasons for this rule to for be required, then how do we say, but in the interim time, it wasn't? I mean, doesn't that comply with the requirement that it be readopted in the sense of, okay, they've made that determination, even though they made it in 2019?
I don't think so, Justice Triano, because on that reasoning, you'd never have a violation of the review provision, right? Anytime you didn't wait, if they waited decades, right, they'd just say, well, look, when we finally got around to it, we told you that it always applied. I'm not challenging the 2019 readoption in and of itself, but I do think it's important that readoption was essentially pro forma. It was done in the face of an enforcement action the state wanted to salvage, the validity challenge we brought here. And I do think it is fair for the court to wonder, look, back in 2004, they said there are inconsistencies and errors after the EPA pointed out the 1998 problem with the tampering rule. So 6 years later, they come along. They say, look, we're readopting the rules, but we know there are inconsistencies and errors, and we're going to fix them. Right? I think it's fair to ask then, in a world in which the state wasn't doing this just to try to save its bacon, but was just being a good actor and doing the quadrennial review, what were those inconsistencies and errors? What would the rule have looked like?
And counsel, based on that, I wanted to ask you, what is the effect of VW taking no action in 2019 to raise to the department there are these inconsistencies that you need to fix? You didn't show up. So why can you complain now about inconsistencies that you wish they had fixed or claim they should have fixed in 2004, even though they knew about them in 1998 and didn't do it in 2004, which you claim relate to the federal complaints? But you didn't show up in 2019 either to say, look, you need to fix these inconsistencies, because that's what we're litigating, these inconsistencies that you think exist in the act.
So, Chief Justice Barnes, a few thoughts. The main one is, I think this is the worst kind of red herring on the other side. We were already litigating with them in the enforcement action. They come in 2019 to consider readopting the...
And I see that we're running out of time, but I'm going to allow you to answer this question.
Thank you. They come in and say they want to readopt the rule in 2019. Everybody knows what the concerns with the rule are, and we don't have any concerns with the rule on a going forward basis, because the enforcement action only applies to 2014, 2016. We don't have a dog in the hunt of the 2019 readoption. Our only point is that on the narrow ground of whether the state substantially complied for the period at issue here, I don't have the state to understand, I don't understand them to have any argument that they substantially complied. That's separate and apart from the rulemaking. It's why we didn't participate, but in all fairness, they were on notice. It's why they were doing the readoption. They didn't need a comment from VW on the same issues that we were litigating with them in the MDL.
And then a quick question, when did VW learn that the review process hadn't been done in 2004, 12, 15? When did VW know that TCEQ wasn't doing these reviews?
We stumbled across it in the process of litigating in the MDL, Justice Smith. We put out discovery to the state. The state said, you know, it opposed the discovery, it made a number of different objections, but then it said we don't have any documents. We moved to depose someone from TCEQ to figure out what the inconsistencies and errors were in 2004. They moved to quash that subpoena. The trial court granted it. So we've had a very difficult time trying to get any clear answer about what the inconsistencies and errors were. And in all honesty, Justice Smith, I think they waited so long, it's not even clear to me anyone at the agency knows. I'm not even sure that the state today will be able to tell you what the agency meant by that in 2004. I think they've waited so long that there may not be anyone there who understands what it meant. We did ultimately get to depose Michael Regan, the TCEQ employee who did the readoption, and the first he ever heard of the inconsistencies and errors in the 2004 and the 1998 EPA problem was at the deposition. When we asked the question, he said, "It's news to me. I've never heard any of this." He had an Excel spreadsheet that kept a few reasons for the rules. He then did the readoption. I mean, this was not a resource-intensive thing. He had no idea about the existing problems with the rule. That's all we've been able to figure out.
And justices, if you don't mind, I'm gonna turn the floor over to Ms. Pettit. Thank you, Mr. Wall.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am, Ms. Pettit.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Volkswagen has admitted that for years it sought to evade environmental regulations by installing defeat devices in its cars, thousands of which ended up on Texas roads. And as Justice Triana has pointed out, it cannot deny that in 2019, TCEQ readopted its anti-tampering rules. It nonetheless asks this court to retroactively excuse it from compliance with those rules because the readoption did not occur in 2012. Now, there are a lot of problems with that, some of which the court has asked about, but I think the most straightforward way to resolve it is the one that Justice Triana pointed out, that it seeks a form of remedy that is not available under the APA. Because that fault is jurisdictional, the court need not get into whether Volkswagen is right on the merits, which it is not, or whether it sought to timely pursue its claims, which it did not. So start with that jurisdictional problem. Volkswagen has relied on a single waiver of sovereign immunity throughout this case. That in 2001.038, which authorizes a declaratory judgment involving the validity and applicability of a rule. That in and of itself is an inherently prospective form of relief. Indeed, as this court pointed out in 2011, in a case called HHSC against El Paso County Hospital District, that particular provision is directly analogous to the UDJA's waiver of sovereign immunity to allow a declaratory judgment about the validity and applicability of a statute.
Ms. Pettit, before we go any further on this, I just want to understand, is the state actually waiving your issue number one, your procedural challenge that the review provision is somehow not subject to the declaratory judgment?
Because it
appears
not,
that you're not waiving it.
No.
Okay, even though in your cross motion for summary judgment, you say that they can bring the STEC action.
So that statement is taken out of context. That was relating to a standing argument, and the very next line in that sentence, or the very next sentence in that paragraph, was that standing was not a problem, a meritless claim was the problem. Moreover, we can't waive that argument because Section 2001.038 it relates to the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. So it is either available or it's not, but we couldn't waive the argument if we wanted to, and that goes to Town of Shady Shores against Swanson.
Okay.
So going back to and that's the same general issue as the availability of retrospective relief, because as the UDJA and this analogous statute do not authorize retrospective relief. We see that in Heinrich. So because Volkswagen has admitted on page 9 of its reply brief that the relief that it seeks is in fact retrospective, it is outside the scope of the waiver of immunity that is applicable here and therefore outside the court's jurisdiction. Now it's also outside of 2001.038 because the challenge they bring does not go to the validity of the rule. And I believe this goes to the Chief Justice's first question about whether their argument would make everything mandatory. And the answer is no, but based on a background principle of a Texas administrative law, which hasn't really been played out in these briefs. Namely, unlike under the federal system, Texas does not have a general presumption in favor of judicial review. You find that unless it is authorized by statute, review is unavailable. And so I would point your honors to TEA against American Youth Works from 2016 in this court, where you look to the specific provisions of the APA as well as the organic statute. In that case, the education code, in our case, the health and safety code and or the Texas water code. So we had some back and forth with my friend on the other side about section 0.035 and 0.040 and whether this provision is outside of that particular framework. And I agree, it is. But because there is no general presumption of judicial review, I believe it was your honor who noted that that might mean there's no consequence at all. And there isn't. So they, for example, said he does not think the state would challenge whether there was public comment and whether that was available for the UDJA. We don't. But that's because that is in 0.029, which falls within the range of provisions that are covered by 0.035. 0.039 does not.
Ms. Pettit, but let me ask you, why would the legislature require agencies to review the rules every 4 years if there's no consequence to the failure to comply?
So there is no judicially enforceable consequence. There are certainly consequences, and I think that there are two potential ones that might respond to Your Honor's direct question, one of which comes from the history of .039 itself. That provision was adopted in 1999, but previous to that, it had been included as riders in General Appropriations Acts for a number of years. So the immediate consequence would be loss of agency funding. Moreover, there are the consequence that the TCEQ is subject to the Sunshine Act, which means that if TCEQ is the bad actor that my colleague suggests, the legislature may make the TCEQ cease to exist. And I do want to stop on the Sunset Act for just a minute, because I think it creates a useful foil for the language at issue in this appeal. Because my colleague has repeatedly used words like expire or lapse. That word does not appear anywhere in .039. But it does appear in the Sunshine Act, and that is 5.014 of the Water Code, which says that if not re-upped, that the agency is abolished and the chapter expires. And it says so in the Sunshine Act itself, which is Texas Government Code 325.017, which again, if TCEQ is not re-upped, all regulations that were adopted by TCEQ will expire. The legislature knows how to create an expiration date. It didn't do so here. And that is similar to what this court recognized in the Vista Healthcare Company case, where there was an analogous requirement that a Medicaid reimbursement rule be reviewed every 2 years. And HHSC didn't do so, and this court called it unfortunate, but noted that it was telling that the legislature had not adopted to spell out a consequence for that.
But doesn't the legislature knows how to spell consequences, and the legislature knows specifically how to say also, and by the way, if the agency does not comply with this regulation, it does not make it void.
It does.
So why wouldn't we read, since there's no consequence, or since the language does not say, by the way, if the agency does not comply with this specific rule, there will be, you know, invalidity is not a consequence, voidability is not a consequence, why should we not take that into consideration in determining that this is mandatory, not directory?
So, because cases dating back to at least Chisholm say so, that silence on this point is telling that there is no consequence, and so that's the presumption that has been created. And my colleague pointed to section .016 of the Code Construction Act. I would point you to .023. Which says that in reviewing a statute and in drafting a statute, courts are to look and drafters are to look to prior constructions given to similar statutes. And here, the prior construction for a law like this, which is about the prompt and best practices effectively of doing business on a state agency without a consequence for not conducting it on a certain time, or without a requirement that says if you miss your deadline, you can no longer do it, it is considered directory rather than mandatory. That's the background rule against which the legislature was drafting this regulation, similar to in Vista Community Health. The legislature opted not to put in a consequence. That's in contrast to other provisions of the APA, for example, .05A, which says that failure to index will invalidate a rule. That's a very specific provision in the APA that says this is what happens. There's nothing like that for .039. Again, because of its history, it was a rule that was designed to foster appropriate review to make sure that rules are no longer moribund, because that is a policy of the state of Texas and has been for a period of time. But it was not one that was judicially enforceable either when it was in the Appropriations Act or now, because there's no consequence that's attached to that.
So, Ms. Pettit, is it your position that this review statute is really there not for the timeliness, the 4 years, but that the fact that a review happens at some time, even if it's 15 years late, if it's a day late, the statute is there to ensure that agencies review their rules at some time and best practices for years? I mean, is that the state's argument on timeliness versus ever doing it?
So the timeliness under the Chisholm line of cases suggests that it is a best practice type statute. It is the state's position that TCEQ was required to do it every 4 years. That is, it's been directed by the legislature to do so, and it should have done it. But it has not, the direction did not create a judicially enforceable mandate. That's the difference. And I would, the day hypothetical that you gave to my colleague that he dodged when he asked that is a really important one. Because in addition to the context and the legislative purpose, the Chisholm line of cases look to tell you to look, and I'm quoting here, the consequences that would fall from each construction, and that's page 403 of Chisholm. He called that a naked policy argument, but that's what Chisholm says to look at. And here, their position would in fact be, if this agency missed it by a day, it's invalid. And that is what's causing the problem. They say, well, you don't have to look at that because there's no substantial compliance here. But that is the implication of their provision, and that is what Chisholm requires this court to look at when deciding whether or not their position is correct.
But even if the statute doesn't require invalidation, how can waiting 15 years ever be substantial compliance?
So substantial compliance looks to whether there is a hampering of the age of the legislature's purpose. And the legislature's purpose is that this review occurred. Now, there were a number of rulemakings in between the 1998 EPA rule that he mentioned, and I'll come back to that in just a second, and the 2019. So it wasn't that this rule was not being reviewed, it just wasn't gone through the formal adoption process. And that was a problem. But the purpose of the legislature, and I'm looking specifically at DeSoto against White, that is relevant for this, is the purpose of the overall statutory scheme. Here, the emission standards and the water code and the TCAA, not the specific rule provision itself. But even if that were not the case, because we reviewed it in 2019, the purpose of this is to determine that the rule still serves the original purposes that it was passed for. If it had served that purpose in 2019, there is no indication that it did not serve that purpose in 2008, or that it was no longer necessary in 2008. It wasn't a springing necessity. There hasn't been that big of a change in the environment in that decade. But turning to that EPA rule and the inconsistencies and errors to which my colleague repeatedly pointed, that statement in 1998 referred to Chapter 114 as a whole. There is no indication that it was specific to 114.20, which is important because Chapter 114 is what is TCEQ's regulations of mobile, of basically motor vehicles. It has something like 8 to 12 subparts, depending on which edition you're looking at. So the fact that there are inconsistencies or errors somewhere in Chapter 114 gives no indication that it relates to 114.20, which is why if they thought there were errors and inconsistency, as one of your honors pointed out, and I'm sorry, I don't remember who, they should have said so in 2019 so TCEQ could have looked at it. They didn't. And so that's a red herring. So in addition to this, we think we've covered, if there are no further questions on either the availability of the remedy, which again, because it's purely retrospective, it's not available under the APA, or the merits, I will turn briefly to the timeliness question, because—
Can I ask one last question?
Certainly,
Let's
Your
Honor. Let's assume the TCEQ had not, in 2019, readopted it, and y'all were here arguing without, then what would the TCEQ's position be?
The TCEQ's position would be the rule remains valid because it's a directory rather than a mandatory requirement. Now, it may be possible that there would be an appropriate mandamus action because it goes similar to a court can't be mandamus to decide one way or the other, it can be mandamus to decide. And so there might be a situation where this is a requirement that the legislature has put out. It does not invalidate the rules in the interim, but it can be required to perform the act. And that goes to some of the cases like, that Loudenheiser is a good example, or Sheps, where there is a distinction between what is mandatory and what is jurisdictional. In addition to this not being mandatory, it doesn't go to the power of the agency. It is an instruction on how the agency is to act from the legislature. So the rule would remain valid, but they could be required, for example, to go back and do it, similar to the questions Your Honor was asking a few minutes ago about 040.
Are there reaffirming rules that do have consequences?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I followed.
Are there other agencies that have reaffirming rules that actually have consequences spelled out?
So I haven't looked at the organic acts of all of the different agencies. There may be. There's none that is specifically related to 039 of which I am aware. But there may, but that again doesn't mean there's no consequences. It just means there's no judicial enforcement of those consequences. It is a political decision or a legislative decision to enforce the legislature's requirements to perform this type of policy review. So,
Ms. Pettidor, when you say you're going into timeliness, are you talking about the statute of limitations?
Yes, Your Honor.
I ask the question, is that not a waived position because of the state of the pleadings and you pleading statute of limitations only after the summary judgment hearing?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, please explain.
So, for a couple of different reasons, the first being that the APA 2-year statute of limitations requirement is a condition on the waiver of immunity, so that particular part can't be waived. However, I would point this court to two different aspects of the case where we raised the statute of limitations before the summary judgment hearing, and or Harris County did, because it's also relevant that Harris County did. Yeah. Harris County raised it in their answer.
But they are not an appellant, right?
They are
they're not a party to this appeal.
So they are not, but they were defendants in the case. And so that's relevant because under Land Title Company of Dallas against F.M. Stigler, the Supreme Court held that pleadings of another defendant give sufficient notice that this issue has been raised. And more directly to our pleadings, we raised it in our motion for summary judgment response at the clerk's record, page 428, and under Keck, Mahin, and Kate against National Union Fire, that is also sufficient to preserve the issue for appeal.
And did Volkswagen not object to you raising that in your motion?
They did.
Did they receive a ruling from Judge Shulock?
So Judge Shulock acknowledged that it was in the pleadings at the motion for summary judgment hearing, but he didn't specifically rule. His only ruling is the unreasoned order that he issued at the judgment stage. So we're not sure what he did one way or the other.
Understood. Thank you.
So turning to that statute of limitations question, this issue should have been raised as a counterclaim in the original suit. They didn't do so, and the time lapsed, which is why we're sort of in this weird posture that we're having this declaratory judgment action that's outside of the declaratory judgment framework created by the APA. Now, that even if the assume that I'm wrong on the 2-year statute of limitations because this is an improper rule challenge, and the 4-year statute of limitations actually is the applicable one. Under cases like Denman, the claim nonetheless arose at the time that there was a controversy, which was in September of 2015, and it lapsed into 2019. This was not raised explicitly until 2021. When they point out that they raised it earlier, what I think my colleague was pointing to, at least at the lectern, was their argument in response to their request, in requesting to amend the answer, where they pointed to a 2018 discovery request asking for documents about enforcement provisions and made no mention of the readoption. That issue did not become clearly raised until at least February of 2021. And that was part of the reason, I think, although Judge Shulock was not clear on this point, that they were not allowed to amend their answer at that time. And so the case was pending for a solid 6 years before it was raised, well more than the 4-year time period. And they pointed out, well, we didn't have a clear answer because there was no discovery. But under their theory, there has to be strict compliance with the procedural rules in the APA of 0225 to 034, which requires public notice and comment. The absence of that public notice and comment was available to anybody because it would have been published in the Texas Register. They didn't need discovery to notice whether or not TCEQ had readopted its rules. So that is just false. And so the claim is untimely. Unless the court has any further questions, we respectfully request that you affirm.
Counsel, justices. Thank you, Ms. Pettit. Mr. Wall.
May it please court.
Yes, sir.
At the outset, the vast bulk of what Ms. Pettit was saying, with all respect, is not in the state's brief. So the idea that this is jurisdictional and not waivable, so their statement in below couldn't waive it, the Sunshine Act, Section 311.23 of the Code Construction Act, and a whole list of cases that are not in their brief, as far as I can tell, Town of Stady Shores, Heinrich, Youth Works, Land Title, Heckman, I lost count. You know, even the statute of limitations argument there at the end as a condition on the waiver of the two-year, none of this is in the state's brief. So as far as I can tell, many of these arguments are at least forfeited, if not waived. But to address them on the merits as best I can, I think it's telling that the state doesn't start with the mandatory jurisdictional. It starts with the availability of the remedy. To your question, Chief Justice Byrne, I'll let the court look at the statement. Ms. Pettit is certainly right. It was made in the context of standing, but the state was looking at .038 and said, you have an injury within the meaning of .038. We don't challenge your ability to bring a claim under .038. Now, if you want to say it's not waiver, it's at least forfeiture. That was the opportunity to say you don't have a remedy under the statute. They didn't say a word. Their only answer to the waiver point, Madam Chief Justice, is, well, it's jurisdictional. But it's not jurisdictional because it's not that the state is sort of here just raising a sovereign immunity defense. They're invoking it as an interpretive principle on a way to read a cause of action statute. And the question of whether you have a cause of action, as the Supreme Court has said in Morrison, Fifth Circuit said before, is a merits question. It doesn't go to the subject matter jurisdiction of courts. And in any event, even if you thought it wasn't waivable, it's wrong. The state brought its own declaratory judgment action. It got a declaratory judgment too under the same provision, and it is here in the conclusion of its brief asking you to affirm. And the reason the state did that, just like Volkswagen, is that the text of .038 is clear. It says if you want to challenge the validity or applicability of a rule, you can bring a declaratory judgment suit. Now, the state, I think, acknowledges that applies to every other part of subchapter B. There is no reason, textual or logical, why it wouldn't apply to the review provision. The state has just left them to say, well, you can't get retrospective relief. You can just get a prospective declaration. That's not the way it works for any other provision. If they didn't do notice or comment or any of the other things required by subchapter B, and a regulated party came in and said this rule was invalid, courts all the time in Texas and everywhere else say, yes, you can't apply the rule because the rule is invalid. No court, as far as I know, they cite nothing for this, has ever said, well, we can only declare it invalid going forward, but you can continue to use it for past conduct, even though your error was in the past. What courts say was, your error infected the rule. It was invalid because you didn't do it the right way. It was never a valid rule, so you can't apply it to these people until you fix the rule.
But this was a valid rule at one point, right?
That's right. It was valid until 2008. And at that point, under our mandatory argument, it stopped being valid. Now, on the directory side, Justice Smith, it could continue to be valid for some period of time until you'd finally say they didn't substantially comply. We could talk about where the limit was, but surely after more than a decade, and this gets to Justice Triana's question, it's just meaningless if the state's right about the review provision. They could say there are political consequences. The legislature could wipe TCEQ out of existence. But there's no remedy for any regulated party on the state's view. And I don't understand. I mean, again, it's just not part of what this court looks at for mandatory directory. You ask whether the court whether the agency substantially complied, Justice Triana. That's a question of whether they fulfilled the essential requirements. And here, the timing is an essential part of it. I mean, when the state says, well, the legislature just wanted a review, and the review occurred in 2019, hence we substantially complied. That'd be true at any point. They could have waited 20 years or 30.
So, counsel,
and timing matters.
Is it VW's position that, okay, so in 2008 plus day one, when they didn't review it the first 4 years, it became invalid, and it remained invalid. Is it your position that there TCEQ's actions in 2019 really couldn't happen because what they really needed to do was to do a new rulemaking? Because, or does it just spring back into life somehow? This invalid rule springs back into life once they do what they're supposed to do under 40.
So it's the latter. I think this is where we disagree with Professor Beal. I understand him to say they've got to do it anew. I mean, the regulation stays on the books, even though it can't be enforced. Once they readopt in 2019, I think it's back in effect. And so I think they were fine to do what they did in 2019 in terms of trying to readopt the rule. The problem is just that they weren't substantially complying in the meantime. And for purposes of statute of limitations, if I could just say one quick thing about it, they acknowledge that it runs from the last time they violated the review provision. They just say that was in 2016. But it's just not realistic. to say, well, you violated it on one day in 2016, but then after that, you were free for another 4 years. They were in violation all the way up until 2019. We brought the suit within 4 years. I think the suit's clearly timely. The court ought to say whether it's mandatory or directory, and on either ground, it ought to reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Thank you, Ms. Pettit. The case is submitted, and the court will stand in recess. Thank you.